Section 6 is called Opening and Servicing Customer Accounts. This is going to represent 12 of the 100 questions on the Series 6. Well, as a registered rep, your job is to find new customers and to help them open their account, and then of course to service the account by monitoring it and making suggestions for adjustments and other products that they may need. When you open a new account, of course you have to use what's called a new account form, sometimes a new account card. What you need to remember here is these are often filled out while you're talking to the new customer over the phone. So if you get a question about who has to sign the new account form, it's actually just the registered rep and the principal. The customer doesn't actually have to sign this form. It's kind of tricky because after you fill this out, you're going to send a copy to the customer and they're going to review the information and then acknowledge that the information is correct or what needs to be changed. The information that you would need to gather from a new customer would include things like their name and residence. Now, you can send materials to a PO box, but you do need to have a street address on the new account form. You need to determine that they are of legal age, they're not a minor. And again, the signature of the rep and the signature of the principal who is accepting or approving the new account. You have to make a reasonable effort to also get the customer's Social Security number or other tax identification number. Like if it's an estate, it has an FEIN. If it's a corporation, it has an FEIN. An individual would generally just give you a Social Security number. Find out their occupation and get the employer name and address. You're also trying to find out if the customer is associated with a FINRA member broker-dealer or their immediate family members might be. And then you need some suitability information. Try to get their objectives, time horizon, risk tolerance, etc. Now, they may not provide all of that information, but you have to make a reasonable effort to gather it. And then if they don't provide, for example, all the suitability information, you have to note that. You tried to get it, but they didn't follow up. If they don't provide a tax ID number or a Social Security number, it could result in a backup withholding, which means that when they receive interest or dividends, you may have to actually send some of that income to the IRS, and then they'd have to deal with it later. So hopefully they will cooperate and give you the tax ID or the Social Security number. So that seems to be a fairly common test question, who signs the new account form. I don't know why they always ask that, as if you would do some huge damage if you tried to get the customer signature, but it's really just the registered rep and the principal. Generally, you're going to just make recommendations to clients and they're going to either accept your ideas or not. If you were working with someone for a while, they might develop such a rapport with you that they give you the power to invest their money without first talking to them. This is called a discretionary account. They're letting the broker-dealer and the registered rep obviously make suitable purchases and sales, but without talking to the client now, you would be able to enter trades. So discretion means that you could choose which security gets bought or sold or how many shares get bought or sold even without talking to the client. Well, we would need a principal to monitor that account very closely, make sure the rep isn't just trying to churn to make commissions or put expensive products in there without having to talk to the client. But it can happen. It just has to be in writing and signed by the client before the first trade is executed. When an account is opened, it may be an individual account. You know, Joe Smith or Barbara Smith comes in and opens up her own account with your broker-dealer. Only that person's going to be giving orders to buy or sell, unless they happen to sign a trading authorization form where they give somebody else also the power to enter trades. A certain type of individual account that might show up is called a TOD or a transfer on death account. It's an individual account, but when the individual dies, the assets pass directly to another individual, bypassing the probate process, they might say. Husbands and wives, or perhaps two or three friends, may want to open a joint account. The two basic types are either joint tenants with rights of survivorship or joint tenants in common. If it's joint tenants with rights of survivorship, that means that when one of the parties dies, the assets go to the other surviving parties. Wouldn't matter how much anybody put in. If it were a husband and wife with a joint tenants with rights of survivorship, when the husband dies, the wife owns all the assets, period, bypassing probate court, they might say. With tenants in common, on the account agreement, the joint account agreement, they indicate how much each individual owns of that account. And if Joanne owns 35% of the account, when she dies, that percent goes to her estate, or they might say her heirs, not the other account owners. There are also fiduciary accounts where somebody acts for the benefit of somebody else. They can call them fiduciary or third-party accounts. We said that you had to make the determination that the customer is of legal age because minor children cannot open their own account. If you want to open an account on behalf of a minor, you may open a UGMA or UTMA account, also called a custodial account, because there has to be an adult acting as the custodian overseeing the investments for the minor child. The difference between UG with a G and an UTMA account, the few states that use UGMA, Uniform Gifts to Minors Act, when that child becomes an adult, he or she owns all the assets, period. And, you know, if the state says that 18-year-olds are adults, then the 18-year-old suddenly could own a $1 million account, and it may be hard to get that kid to go to college and so forth. Most states use Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, UTMA accounts. Like here in Illinois, I'm the custodian for one of my friend's kids' accounts. And under this, the assets aren't going to belong to this kid until he's actually, really an adult in my mind, age 25. So for an UTMA, the assets don't really transfer until the so-called child is 25. For UGMA, as soon as the kid becomes an adult, controls the assets. In another section, we talked about 529 plans versus the Coverdell. The Coverdell acts a little bit like an UGMA. As soon as the kid becomes legally an adult, he or she owns the assets. Now, there's some special tax treatment of an UGMA or UTMA account, which we'll just call custodial accounts. And since they receive the special tax treatment, if you're acting as the custodian, say for your niece's account, you better not be using any of that money for your own benefit. If they found out that you're making little advances to one of your businesses or paying your American Express card after making withdrawals from that account, you could get in huge tax problems with the IRS. You can take money out, but only for the benefit of the child. Maybe she wants to take violin lessons or go to soccer camp. That's okay. But don't ever use it for the benefit of the custodian. Everything has to be used for the benefit of the minor child. Only one adult acting as custodian and only one minor child per account. Is it a joint account? Absolutely not. It's a third-party account where an adult acts as custodian for the benefit of the minor. If they ask you what the maximum gift is, they're messing with you. There's no limit on how much money I could contribute to my friend's son's UTMA account. It's just that I don't have $7 million. If I did, though, I could actually put that in there. It would probably not be a great move because of gift taxes, but that's a different question. So there's no maximum gift. Now, with an UGMA account, as soon as the kid is 18 or maybe 21, he or she owns all the assets, and there's nothing I could do to stop him from liquidating everything. Or even though most states use UTMA, UTMA accounts, by the time the kid's 25, they may or may not really be grown up. If I'm worried about that kind of situation where, my son or my niece may not be very responsible with the money I leave them, it might be better to set up a trust account where I have a trust agreement that governs how much money can be distributed and what kind of investments can go in there and so forth. And maybe the so-called kid can't even start to take money out until he's 45. Make sure that kid at least learns what work is about, that kind of thing. Well, that's a trust account, and you can certainly control that a lot more than with UGMA or UTMA. An estate account just means that if your grandmother, for example, passes away, her will may have named you the executor of the estate. That just means that all of her assets, CDs, bank accounts, checking accounts, clothing, furniture, the piano, everything you can imagine, farmland, the house, they all go into this legal entity known as an estate. And you may open up an investment account. I did that when I was the executor for an estate because the estate's going to be open for at least a few months. In our case, it was open for several years, and I was glad I opened a brokerage account in the name of the estate so that the money you make after you sell the house, for example, could go into mutual funds or maybe very conservative stocks and bonds. It just depends on how long the account's going to be open. Usually an estate closes out in 6 months, so any of the investments would probably just be very short-term money market type investments. Another type of fiduciary account, I guess it could show up, is called a guardian account. If, let's say, a child tragically loses both of her parents to a car crash, the courts may establish a guardian for that child, and the guardian may want to open an investment account where they act as basically the custodian on behalf of the minor child. Or if an adult becomes mentally incompetent, the courts may appoint someone to oversee investments for that individual. Call that a guardian account. Businesses may open up investment accounts. If you open up an account for a partnership or for a corporation, you're going to have to get documentation to make sure that these partners or these corporate officers do have authority to invest money that really belongs to the corporation. And you might want to see what type of restrictions the corporation has put into its charter, that maybe no margin can be used or no options or no, you know, other high-risk strategies. And some other rules that may show up are fairly new, in the recent past anyway. Broker-dealers are like banks in the sense that they could be used by criminal organizations to launder money. So the Bank Secrecy Act gave the U.S. Treasury Department the power to require banks and broker-dealers and other financial institutions to help spot any potential criminal activity that's going on through their institution. And many broker-dealers have been actually taken out of the business because they will not help help the U.S. Treasury, you know, spot this potential money laundering. So if somebody opens up an account at your broker-dealer and they start doing suspicious things, your firm is actually required to file a suspicious activity report with Treasury. Now, there may be nothing wrong going on here with a wire transfer, but if a wire transfer is coming into the customer's account, if the transfer is for $3,000 or more, there has to be detailed information about who's sending the money to whom. Anytime a customer uses more than $10,000 cash in the same day, they come in to deposit $10,000 or buy securities with cash. If it's more than 10 grand, they may not be doing anything wrong, but you do, as a broker-dealer, have to file a currency transaction report, a CTR. So we're not worried about cash or, you know, cashier's checks or wire transfers in that sense. It's just if it's cash money, then you have to report a currency transaction report. Most people would probably use a check. But, you know, they're afraid, is this money laundering? Is this Tony Soprano taking illegal cash from Bada Bing and trying to launder it through a broker-dealer? Just to be sure, a currency transaction of more than 10 grand cash. And the test is more likely to have, like, two transactions on the same day. Somebody buys $6,000 of stock for cash in the morning and $5,000 in the afternoon. That's more than 10 grand that day. You would have to do a CTR. The main stages of money laundering, the test is, I think, very likely to ask this question. The first stage is called placement, and that's when these illegally gotten funds are placed into the system. Tony Soprano has taken actually shakedown money and putting it into a broker-dealer account. Then layering is when a confusing set of transactions is conducted to try to hide the source of the funds. And then integration, that's the stage when the funds are invested in legitimate enterprises. Now, how that helps you become a better rep, I really don't know. All right, so you got a currency transaction report. If the customer deposits or buys with more than 10 grand cash money on the same day, you have to fill that out. Anything that looks suspicious, you need to file a suspicious activity report. And signs that there may be something suspicious would include that the customer seems to have no concern for risk. You know, the customer is making a lot of transactions based on wire transfers, and it just, we're, you know, we're not criminal experts, but this looks like it really doesn't pass the smell test. You have to file a suspicious activity report. And then again, I would know the three stages of money laundering: placement, layering, and integration. When you're opening the account under what we call the customer identification program, you need a photo ID these days, and you need to, you actually do need to know the date of birth now when you're identifying the customer, so that's kind of tricky. But you need a taxpayer ID number. You need, if they're not a U.S. citizen, you're going to need their passport number or an alien ID card. You know, and if they do live in the U.S., you need like a driver's license or a state ID. So opening accounts in the past, you didn't have to do that photo ID, but you know, we want to make sure broker-dealers don't open up an account for a terrorist, obviously, or any other criminal. And speaking of terrorism, when you open up an account for a customer these days, you have to check to see that they're not on that list of suspected terrorists with the Office of Foreign Asset Control, OFAC. So, you know, it would be embarrassing to open up an account for a Mohammed Atta, that kind of thing. But if their name is on this list, you would not be able to open up the account, or you'd have to take special procedures. So before you open up an account under Customer Identification Program, you got to verify who this person is, make sure they're not a suspected terrorist or somebody working for the mob. But you also have to, under Regulation SP, you have to protect customers' sensitive information. You may be getting customer information that you're then going to dispose at the firm. Well, you have to have procedures to dispose of it properly. It'd be very bad if you threw out a bunch of old computers and people could just grab the hard drives with all the sensitive data. A firm would get fined severely under that. The test questions may focus on the difference between a consumer and a customer. A consumer is somebody that's considering opening up an account with your firm. They're a customer when they actually do. And you have to give a privacy notice when they become a customer, and then annually. You probably get these from your bank or your insurance company. Maybe you read them, maybe you don't. But these financial companies do have to send their privacy notice annually to customers and when they establish the account. You know, and there has to be an opt-out program where if this customer doesn't want you selling any of their information to a third party, then you can't do it. FINRA has rules about how you protect customers' securities or funds. The broker-dealer has custody. They also have their own proprietary trading account. They have to have books and records that make it clear that these are the firm's securities, these are the customer's securities. Even if we're holding them in street name on behalf of the customer, it has to be very clear whether the firm owns these shares or whether they're held on behalf of customers. It may be tempting to offer somebody a guarantee, or look, I'm so confident that this mutual fund's going up. If it doesn't, I'll give you your money back. You can't make those offers. You cannot offer guarantees against loss or promises of profit. Also, borrowing from or lending to customers opens up a big can of worms. The bottom line here is that you have to check your firm's policy. Your firm may allow you to borrow from certain clients. Maybe the client is in your immediate family. Maybe it's somebody that you've been doing business with for 20 years. You know, you guys started a bagel cart business or something, and you've got an established relationship with this person. Your firm may or may not allow you to borrow money from or lend money to these people, but the bottom line is you have to check your firm's policy. So they may say, if it's immediate family, you don't even have to tell us. More likely, they're going to say, you need to alert us that you're going to borrow money from or lend money to any of your customers. And then we may say it's okay to do it with a family member or somebody that you've got an established business relationship with. Or we might say, no, we don't want you to borrow money from or lend money to any client. So FINRA tells the broker-dealers what they can allow. But more importantly, your firm will tell you how this works and doesn't work. I've seen a lot of agents get fined big money and bounced from the business either temporarily or permanently because they were trying to borrow money from clients. Usually what happens is they borrow 20 grand because their back's up against the wall. Maybe they have a gambling problem or they bought some really bad real estate deal and then they just can't pay them back. It's a terrible situation. The firms often end up stepping in and making good on it, but that's very expensive to the firm. So borrowing money from customers is not only going to get you in trouble with FINRA, it'd probably get you fired from the broker-dealer as well. Firms can only distribute mutual funds and variable annuity products through other member firms. So the test may say that a broker-dealer who's a member of FINRA can't give any customer who's not a member of FINRA any type of special deals or discounts. They can give discounts to the broker-dealers in the mutual fund network. You know, American Funds Distributors has all these broker-dealers selling the Growth Fund and the Income Fund of America. They can give them special price deals, but if anybody is not a member of FINRA, they have to be treated like any other public customer. As far as you opening up an investment account at another firm, it can happen, but when you fill out or give information to the new firm and they're doing their new account form that we started out talking about, they're going to ask you, do you work for a member firm? And you're going to have to say, yes, I do. Well, then they're going to have to notify your firm. And if your firm wants to get trade confirmations every time you buy or sell duplicates, they can request that, only upon request. But they're going to tell you, look, we have to notify your employer, and they will notify your employer that one of their employees is going to open an investment account with them, which seems kind of politically incorrect, but I guess if you work for Schwab and you don't have a problem opening an account with TD Ameritrade, TD Ameritrade is going to have to notify your employer and ask them if they want duplicate trade confirmations. That's actually going to be true of your husband or wife or your kids too. You know, if a woman's 52 and works at a broker dealer, you know, her husband is also going to have to, when he opens accounts, indicate, yes, my wife, my immediate family does work for a member firm. We need special records there. Now, stocks and mutual funds, especially mutual funds, should be expected to pay some type of income dividends, but that's never a reason to talk somebody into hurrying up and buying the mutual fund. As the mutual fund prospectus would tell them, if we're about to distribute a dollar per share, the share price will also drop by a dollar per share, so you could just wait, because you're going to get this dividend and then it's going to be taxed. At whatever rate dividends are taxed, you're never going to keep 100% of that. So selling dividends is a violation where you try to tell somebody they need to hurry up and buy the dividend. It's erroneous. The dividend will come out of the share price, so they could just wait and then avoid the tax. They may want to buy it, they may not, but there's no reason that they have to hurry up. Otherwise, you're doing selling dividends. When you violate rules like unauthorized transactions, you know, you did not have discretion, but you started trading a customer account anyway. That's just one example. Unsuitable recommendations. Sending somebody a bogus account statement because you don't want to admit that they're down 48% this quarter. Any of that kind of stuff, or even working outside the firm without permission, that would be a violation of the member conduct rules. Excuse me. And if the test asks you, well, how are violations of member conduct rules handled? It's under FINRA's Code of Procedure, COP. I mean, you get to tell your side, and you know, you could have an attorney help you, but obviously if it's gone this far, you're probably going to end up being fined and at least suspended for a few weeks, few months, maybe even permanently barred depending on what you did. I mean, if you were taking money out of clients' accounts, there's very little chance you're going to remain in the business. But you get to go through the hearing process under Code of Procedure. You have some appeals to this. You go through the first round. If you don't like the decision, you can appeal to the National Adjudicatory Council, the NAC. If you don't like their decision, you can appeal to the SEC. And if you don't like that, you can even go into the Federal Court of Appeals. If you're super well-funded and it was really worth fighting, you know, maybe they shut down your broker-dealer and you intended to win on appeal. Okay, it's there, you know, but most reps are probably just going to go one round, and if they're barred, then they're basically done. When you find out that you're in trouble with FINRA, you may not want to argue at all and just do acceptance, waiver, and consent, AWC. You don't dispute the allegations, you waive your right to appeal, and you consent to what the disciplinary committee says, you know, 2-week suspension and a $5,000 fine. Maybe you realize that's about as good a deal as I'm going to get. What can FINRA do? They can censure you, you know, and suddenly you're in broker check with something to explain when you come out to my house to sell me a variable annuity. They can fine you any amount that they feel is appropriate. What would happen if they fined you $3 million? You'd probably quit. And then they'd say, well, that the payment of the fine is going to have to happen before you ever get back in the business. Yeah. So you're gone and they're happy. And that's usually how that works. A suspension means something temporary, maybe for a year, maybe even 2 years. They can expel a broker-dealer, an expulsion, they're done, to an individual, whether it's an agent or a principal. They wouldn't use the word expulsion, they'd call it barred. You know, and basically every broker-dealer out there would have bars over the doors and windows as far as you're concerned. Very tough. A few more things before we cover this. When you take a purchase order from a customer, if they don't already have the cash in the account, you do have to ascertain that they will be able to make payment. Or, you know, in the old days, people would hold stock certificates, so if they sold them, you'd have to ascertain you can actually deliver these in time for our T+3 settlement. Some of these other things that I mentioned in the book, I'm not sure I'm going to bring up right here. Well, I just want to bring up Code of Arbitration. So Code of Procedure handles violations of the rules. Somebody made unsuitable recommendations, was churning, made an unauthorized transaction, something terrible like that. That would be a disciplinary matter that FINRA would handle with fines and other penalties. Code of Arbitration means there's a dispute. You know, all these broker-dealers form a syndicate when there's an initial public offering, and maybe they disagree as to how much money each one of them was supposed to make. They'd have to take that to arbitration. They'd go before the arbitration panel. Those guys would make one decision, and there basically is no appeal. So people in the business have to use arbitration to settle disputes like that. A customer only has to use it if she's signed an arbitration agreement when you got her to open the account. And that's why almost all, if not all, broker-dealers would insist that the customer sign that agreement, or they probably wouldn't even open the account. They don't want to leave the customer open to the civil court process where if they lose, they can keep appealing and appealing and appealing. There really are no appeals to arbitration, just like in professional baseball. Some big home run hitter feels that he was owed more money on his contract. He can take it to arbitration, but he only gets one shot. So when the customer signs up with your firm, you're going to get them to sign a pre-dispute arbitration clause, but it has to be very clear to the customer what they're giving up and what this arbitration means. It means we won't be used in civil court, we won't have a jury, you won't have the ability to appeal. The awards are final and binding, so the customer says that she should get 60 grand back, they award 10 grand, that's the end of it. The parties don't get to obtain documents the way you would get the process of discovery to a bigger extent in civil court. The arbitrators don't have to explain the reasons for their decisions. And a lot of the arbitrators come from this industry. They may not be that sympathetic to somebody who only lost, half her account value. So all this has to be made clear. But then when the customer signs this pre-dispute arbitration clause, they'd have to use arbitration if they feel that they were wronged and they deserve to get some money back. What else do we need to do here? Oh yeah, just a few things. A few specific things under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. You do have to send trade confirmations to customers. That's exactly what it sounds like. It's an electronic or a paper document that confirms all the terms of the transaction. You guys don't sell individual shares of stock, but if you did, I have stacks of trade confirmations where I bought 100 shares of Oracle at $18.95 plus a $9.99 commission for a total amount of, bought it on this day, settled on that date. The customer's supposed to save this for tax purposes, but they should also review the confirmation to make sure that it's what they thought they bought or sold. And that has to be delivered no later than settlement, which for stocks, and corporate bonds, and muni bonds would be T plus 3. Your firm is a member of FINRA. You'll notice that they're also a member of SIPC, S-I-P-C. That way, if they have custody of client securities and cash, if the broker-dealer goes belly up and the assets are basically gone, then what happens here is that SIPC would step in and protect a customer account up to a maximum of 500 grand, of which only 100 grand could be uninvested cash. So you don't want to hang out with a big uninvested cash position at a broker-dealer. As long as you keep it no more than 100 grand, you're set. Even if the broker-dealer goes belly up and, where are my securities and where's my cash, SIPC would cover each one of your accounts up to 500 grand. But out of that total, only $100,000 of cash money. People often wonder, where does this cash come from? Well, when you cut a check for 10 grand to deposit into your account, that's cash now. When you receive dividends or interest payments, that's cash. When you sell stock, maybe you don't buy anything else for a few weeks. It's sitting there as cash. It's only covered up to 100 grand out of the $500,000 total. Reg T and Reg U. Reg T says that a customer has to pay for a securities transaction no later than 2 days after regular way settlement. So if it settles at T plus 3, they have to pay 2 business days after that, or the broker-dealer would have to get an extension. Reg T also says that in a margin account, only half the value of the customer's stock that they're going to buy can be given as a loan. So if they're going to buy $100,000 of stock, the broker-dealer can only lend them half, or $50,000. Now, they may change that. It may not always be 50%. But Reg T says this is how much of a loan you can extend to a customer when they pledge the stock or this bond as collateral. Reg U, Regulation U, these are both under the Federal Reserve Board, by the way, Reg T and Reg U. Reg U tells a bank how much credit they can extend to the broker-dealer. So basically, the customer is pledging the stock that they're going to buy on margin to the broker-dealer. Reg T tells the broker-dealer how much credit to extend. Then the broker-dealer takes these assets to a bank to get the loan, and Reg U tells the bank how much credit they can extend to the broker-dealer. Again, SIPC, I would just go to SIPC.org. They have a really good explanation of what they are. But you wouldn't do business with a broker-dealer not covered by SIPC. Because that means, again, even if they go belly up, the broker-dealer who held your cash and securities, SIPC is an industry-funded nonprofit insurance organization that makes customers whole. Well, there are a few more details in the book, but again, that's covering the fundamentals, and I think we're going to leave it at that, people.